I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum today. Just to go through the security housekeeping items, everyone here today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need further accommodation, please communicate with the sergeant's staff. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifier's table. Please leave signs outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. All of the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to those time limits. Thank you to our sergeant's office and Capitol Security staff, State Patrol, who are here helping maintain decorum in the committee room. Members, there are three bills on the agenda and one presentation. Thank you to everyone who submitted letters and written testimony. Committee materials are posted online, and there are limited copies for the public at the front entrance. The first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Curran may have a motion to approve the minutes for April 8, 2026.
So moved, Chair Mueller.
Representative Curran moves approval of the minutes for April 8, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes for April 8, 2026 are approved. First bill on the agenda is House File 4446. This is Representative Johnson's bill. And I will move to lay over House File 4446. Members, we had a full hearing on this bill before. And the bill was laid over. Also, House File 2817, Representative Knutson's bill, was heard on the committee on March 25th. That bill was also laid over. And I understand that both of you and the stakeholders have come together with an agreement and put it all together in a DE2. And so I'm happy to see both of you up there at the testifiers' table. Representative Johnson, I think you're the one carrying the DE2 amendment. And would you like to move the amendment to get the bill in the shape that you desire?
Yes, Chair, I'd like to move that DE2.
All right. Any discussion? Oh, we actually have an oral amendment on the DE2 amendment. This is my last day chairing this committee, so you all are going to make it complicated for me today. All right. Mr. Deeball, would you explain the oral amendment for the DE2, please?
Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment would be to page 3, line 29 of the DE amendment, coded H4446DE2. On that line, you would delete February 1st, 2020, and insert January 1st, 2020. Okay. And this would align the look-back periods in the bill to the same date. Currently, there are two different look-back periods, off by 1 month.
Well, thank you. I have a preference for February 1st because it's my birthday, but for the sake of the bill, any discussion to the oral amendment? Okay, and I will be the one offering the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Now we'll move to the DE2 amendment as amended. Any discussion to the DE2 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The DE2 amendment as amended is adopted. Okay, now with that out of the way, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'll be brief. We did just hear House File 4446, but as we amended here with the DE, it includes a couple other pieces. The piece that I'll hit on is just the firefighter cancers, certain cancers being counted as line of duty death benefit eligible. This bill, we talked about last time, the other pieces that came in with some discussion with Department of Public Safety has to do around some clarifying of language and getting us more in line with some of the federal definitions as far as the type of work, strenuous, non-strenuous, et cetera. But I'll also let Representative Knutson talk a little bit about her portion of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Knutson.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, committee. My portion of the bill was House File 2817, which was heard in this committee a couple weeks ago. My portion of the bill would add part-time and paid on-call firefighters to the firefighters that qualify for the line of death benefits if the unthinkable would happen. Currently, it's just volunteer and full-time firefighters that fall into that category, and we just want to add part-time and paid on-call.
Sorry about that. Had a question for my CA. Are we ready for the testifiers then?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to invite up Julie Pidar. She has a really important story to share. She was not able to be here when we first heard House File 4446. And here she
is. All right. Welcome to the committee. And when you're ready, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Good afternoon, Chair Moeller and the members of the committee. My name is Julie Pidar, and I stand before you today to express my strong support for HF 4446. Occupational cancer is devastating. It's a devastating reality faced by our brave firefighters and their families. Each day, these individuals selflessly put their lives on the line to protect our communities, and they deserve recognition and support that reflects the sacrifices they make. Just like those who suffer fatal injuries in the line of duty, families dealing with the aftermath of occupational cancer experience profound loss and grief. Their lives are forever altered, and they should not have to battle an inefficient system to receive the acknowledgement and assistance they rightfully deserve. Minnesota's acknowledgement of line of duty deaths is vital. When the state recognized that my husband, Mike, lost his life to cancer, it's a cancer that he contracted while serving as a firefighter, it was a moment filled with both sorrow and pride. That determination affirmed that his service did matter to the state. It honored his sacrifices, and it promised us that he would not be forgotten. Cancer is the most common cause of firefighter line of duty deaths, but to date, Mike is the only firefighter who has been ruled eligible for the state public safety officer's benefit program. For over 5 years, my family has advocated for changes to the PSOB system, both at the state and the local levels, to ensure that occupational cancer is recognized in the same way as other line of duty death injuries. Our experiences navigating this complex system have revealed the immense challenges grieving families face. But I believe that no family should have to endure administrative red tape and meet a burden of proof while mourning their loved one. The state's acknowledgement of cancer as a line of duty death can't be on a case-by-case basis. It must be presumptive. HF 4446 is an important step in addressing these issues. It not only aims to provide justice for those who have fallen victim to occupational cancer, but also to ensure that their families receive the necessary support without struggles. We urge you to consider the sacrifices made by our firefighters and their families, and to support HF 4446 for a fair and compassionate recognition of their service and struggles. This bill mirrors the federal legislation passed in December, and it would ensure that surviving family members receive protection for both the state and the federal governments. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today and for your commitment to supporting our valued first responders and their families. We know firsthand the challenges and the burdens families face after such a loss, and we will return every year if it is necessary to ensure that no grieving family must navigate unnecessary barriers to receive the recognition and support their loved one has rightfully earned. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and I think I can speak on behalf of the committee and just tell you how sorry we are for your loss and the unimaginable sacrifice that your family had and to serve other people. And we also really appreciate your advocacy trying to fight for other victims in the same way. So thank you for that. And I don't think we had anybody else sign up to testify. We do have a chief who's here available for questions. And so then we can move on to member discussion. And I have Representative Rapinski on the list.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to state, as a former volunteer, paid part-time, on-call firefighter, I really can appreciate this bill. And I want to thank Representative Johnson for bringing this forward and this bipartisan bill, along with Representative Rahar and Witte and Steer and some others. So thank you very much, Representative Johnson, for bringing this forward. It needed to be done. It's good to see that it's finally being accomplished. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Any other member discussion? All right. Seeing none, any closing remarks from either of you?
Just want to say thank you to Chair, members, my co-presenter, Representative Knutson here, and all the advocates and staff that worked on the various different parts of this bill to get it to this point. And a special thank you to the Piter family for their advocacy at both the state and federal level. Their work has really created a pathway for other families who have lost loved ones to not only receive the benefits, but have that death be acknowledged for what it is. This bill in its entirety ensures that when firefighters die in the line of duty, regardless of the cause, that sacrifice is honored. So thank you very much.
Anything further from you, Representative Knutson?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, committee, and let's get this done.
All right, thank you. I renew the motion and lay over House File 4446 as amended. And Representative Johnson will stay there because the next bill is also his bill, House File 4066. And I believe that you do have an author's amendment on this bill, the DE3. Okay, we're passing it. They're passing it out right now, so we'll give them a minute so everybody has a chance. Did you want to talk about the DE3 before we adopt it? Maybe you can discuss it while the committee's getting a copy.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. The DE3 really narrows the scope of the bill significantly, and we had the DE2 posted on Friday. This even narrows it down and clears up some confusion that was raised over the weekend with some of the folks in the profession. In essence, what it does is it takes a bill that had a lot of things from training hours and types of training and how it would be applied and everything else, and it narrows it down to just creating five separate tiers for these security officers or protective agents. And then some of the questions from folks in the industry were around what happens if they have somebody who works in multiple different tiers, and that's what this DE does additionally, is it says that they would attempt to put them in the highest tier that they work so that they don't have to guess which, if they're bouncing back and forth where to put them, they would just put them in the highest tier that they work. And then thank you to nonpartisan staff for catching the last little bit there to add in that nothing in this paragraph authorizes an employer to assign an employee or an employee to perform duties for which an employee has not completed the minimum statutory and administrative training requirements.
All right, any discussion to the DE3 amendment? And just to be clear, it's replacing the DE2, so we're not going to do that one. Any questions or comments on the DE3? All right, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE3 amendment is adopted. All right, do you have more that you want to say about the bill?
I'll just do a quick introduction, Perfect. A little bit about the tiers. Please. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair members. Last year we heard House File 1686, which focused on increasing training content and training hours for security officers or protective agents. And in that discussion and some of the feedback, one of the things that came to light for me was the drastically different role that these folks play in these professions. House File 4066, as amended, creates a starting space where we can start to categorize that work that is being done and by whom, through the establishment of a five-tier framework for security officers, clarifying duties that are performed. Tier one is the lower risk functions like access control, crowd management, traffic direction, things like that, where there's minimal expectation of a use of force. Tier two includes routine building security and patrols without any detention authority. Tier three moves into higher risk, unarmed roles where detention may be required. Tier four includes armed security in a high-risk environment, such as critical infrastructure or armored transport. And then tier five covers armed security for individuals or groups. Security officers are increasingly filling gaps in communities that are facing staffing shortages and rising safety concerns. We are asking them to do more, respond to things like medical calls or behavioral health incidents, assist in crises, coordinate with first responders, all while Minnesota law lacks clear statutory roles and definitions. House File 4066 takes a compromise or a common sense step forward in codifying these different levels, clarifying responsibilities, and creating a framework that respects the reality of the modern security work. While it does not solve every challenge, it lays out a foundation to hopefully build off for stronger, more targeted training and standards as well as career pathways. And with that, I'll turn it over to testifiers.
All right, great. And I think you have two testifiers. We have Jonelle Vaugh and Deb Sievers, if you both want to make your way to the testifiers table. And while they're coming up, I'll just note that there are a number of letters in the packet, but I think some of the letters we were getting emails to were coming in based on the language of the original bill, not even the DE2, and now we've got the DE3, so just want to flag that.
Chair, I will say I did read all 11 letters last night. 9 of the 11 were addressing the whole bill to address the amendment, and then to help try and clarify some of those concerns is where the DE3 was born.
Perfect. Thank you. And so I don't know who wants to go first, but Jonelle Vaugh is on the list, so please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you to the chair and member of the committee. My name is Jonelle Vaugh, and I am a security officer as well as an executive board member for SEIU Local 26. Our union represents over 8,000 property service workers in Minnesota, with thousands of those members being security officers. I am here today in support of House File 4066, a bill that will help establish clear industry standard for different levels of security guards. We support this bill because we believe it is important. It is an important first step towards improving the security officer industry in our state. I stand before you today not only as a worker, but also as a voice for countless people who are doing everything right, yet still struggle to make ends meet. Our work is important, which is why we fight so hard to ensure our industry is treated with the respect it deserves. As a union, we have long fought to improve this critical industry and address the harm caused by low wages. Low wages mean exhausted workers juggling multiple jobs, family living paycheck to paycheck, and communities stressed to the breaking point. We know what happens when wages rise. Life changes, stress turns into stability, and struggle turns into opportunity. Workers can breathe again, and our workforce becomes stronger. Yet, our industry is often misunderstood. Security officer with similar title may face vastly different responsibilities and challenges. While all of us deserve higher pay, better benefits, and improved training, passing this bill is necessary first step to legally clarify the different level of security officers. This legislation would make these tiers clear, allowing us to focus on the next crucial steps, ensuring all security officers are treated with the respect and fairness they deserve. I urge you to pass House File 4066 so that we can establish standard for our industry and ultimately improve the lives of the people like me who work every day to keep our community safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Deb Sievers, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deb Sievers, and I have been a security officer for 7 years. I'm a member of SEIU Local 26, and I am here today in support of House File 4066, to put into law the different levels of work for security officers in Minnesota. I have spoken about issues in the industry at the Capitol before, and I'm glad this is being heard today as this is an important issue. In the 7 years being a security officer, I have enjoyed meeting so many different people. I like seeing people smile at my sites because I know that means people feel safe being in our buildings. It feels great at the end of the day knowing I've done my job and no one got hurt. But the reality is that most security officers don't get enough training or provide clear guidelines on our roles, which is a huge problem. The bill would clarify levels of security officers, which would be a very good first step for all of us, and we need improved training to follow this step. I was a bus operator for Metro Transit for 13 and a half years, and every year we had right to know training, which is more training than I ever got as a security guard. Through the training, we had de-escalation, active shooter, see something, say something, and more. This bill would be a first step towards us trying to professionalizing our critical work. Sometimes we are the only staff in the building. We protect buildings worth millions of dollars and interact with so many people, and I think we deserve the tools to be better prepared. We're there to be the first line of defense in our community. Our job is to keep everyone else safe. I hope you want reliable and trained people doing this work. This bill would set industry standards at different levels of security guards and is a basic first step for our industry here in Minnesota. Clarifying standards and then increasing training down the road would help guards feel confident we'd be able to face the different situations we know come up. Training not only will make everyone more safe, but it will make this job more of a profession and keep good people doing this important work. Please vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. And I think you have somebody else here for questions if needed as well, but nobody else signed up to testify, so we can move on to member discussion. Any questions or comments? Chair Navat. Representative Rapinski.
I just have one quick question. Would CPR training be required in this also? I didn't see this listed.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I probably defer to Greg Cook, Executive Director of Private Detectives and Protective Agents Board. That's close. I don't know what all their current standards are for the onboarding. This doesn't change any of the training standards that they currently have. So if those are included currently, then they would continue to be included. But
okay, thank you.
Okay. Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Johnson, who's going to be providing this training?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Novotny, the training, this doesn't change anything with training. All it does is create a tier system where the license holders must attempt to place employees in the highest tier that they would be doing work. So it doesn't change any of the current requirements, any of the onboarding training, any of the continuing education training, doesn't change any of the topics. So whoever's currently providing all the training would continue to provide the training. As we go forward.
And just for clarity, that's because of the DE3 amendment.
Correct.
Versus the original bill as drafted had training components in it, which have now been taken out because of the DE3. Is that just for the record? Is that
correct, Madam Chair? Okay. And that all those things were taken out partially due to the cost associated with the board needing to hire a bunch of FTEs to ensure that training was happening, do the audits, things like that.
Chair Novotny?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I just thought that was important to get that on the record and get the contrast of the DEs. Thank you.
All right. I don't see anything further. Any closing remarks, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Chair. The work that these folks do in and around our communities is extremely important, but a lot of these roles are vastly different. It was highlighted when we heard House File 1686 last session, where we had Ms. Sievers up here talking about the work that she does and the training that she's received, and then we had a former Green Beret talking about the work that he does and his training and experience that he received. I think it's important. This is a very, very small first step that at least tries to get an idea of where people in this industry are doing this work and what they're doing, and then it allows us to come back and take a better look at do we need to change any of the training things for these specific levels. If you're providing executive level armed services, maybe you should have some other types of training as far as EMS and things like that. Maybe if you're doing the level of traffic control or crowd control, you need less so that those different agencies can get folks in the door. Some of the concerns that we did here had to do with the tiers and how it would be difficult to move people around. And I think having the tiers that when somebody is hiring somebody and they say, you're going to do tier 3 work or you're going to do tier 2 work, it would probably set a better expectation for both the employee and the employer that what type of work they're getting into, so they don't get hired thinking they're going to do one thing and then get moved into a role that falls currently within that same standard doing very, very different work. So this just at least allows us to get a look at it and then allows us to better focus on different things as we move forward. So again, this is just a first step toward modernizing a system, distinguishing the different roles that security officers play in and out throughout our community. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And I renew the motion and lay over House File 4066 as amended. All right, you are out of the hot seat now. Thank you. And next we're going to move on to the governor's budget presentation. We're going to be hearing a presentation from the Department of Public Safety on the governor's supplemental budget request. We do not have the bill in the committee's possession, but we do have printed copies for you in your committee packets and PowerPoint slides so that you can follow along. Give you a minute to set up here.
Might need those.
There you go. Sorry.
All right. Welcome back to the committee. And you know the drill. Before you begin, if you can state your name for the record.
Yes. Hello, Chair Mueller, Chair Novotny, members of the Public Safety Committee. My name is Bob Jacobson, and it's an honor to serve as the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and I'm happy to be here today. Thank you for inviting the Department of Public Safety here to present the Governor's Public Safety Supplemental Budget for 2026. And you can go on to the next slide. Very quickly, the Governor's Gun Violence Prevention Package is part of the 2026 Supplemental Budget Proposal. The Governor proposed a comprehensive package to address gun violence. The proposal includes several common sense measures that would make Minnesotans safer. It includes funding for a public awareness campaign for extreme risk protection orders. It also includes a proposal around common sense measures to limit the availability of some of the most dangerous firearms and equipment, including a binary trigger ban. On to the next slide. We also have a part of the governor's supplemental budget. There's a public safety officer impersonation and political assassination piece. In response to the tragic events of June 14th, the public safety supplemental budget also includes measures to increase the penalties for impersonating a police officer, requiring decommissioning of law enforcement vehicles before they are sold to the public, and adding the crime of political assassination in the first degree murder statute. I appreciate that a version of some of these are included in House File 1082, which the committee is hearing, I believe, later today. The next slide, theft of public funds, is also part of the governor's package. The governor recommends adding a theft of public funds statute and increasing the penalty for this crime. As you know, we have said many times that the state program fraud is not a victimless crime and impacts Minnesotans who rely on the services this funding supports. This provision would ensure that fraudsters who steal from these vital programs will now be held accountable. With that, I will now turn it over to our Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Allison Frohley.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair and committee. I am Allison Frohley. I am the Director of the Homeland Security Emergency Management Division within the Department of Public Safety. And so I'm here to, just as a reminder, that the School Safety Center does sit under the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division. And with that, part of the supplemental budget is a proposal for the School Safety Center to augment resources as far as personnel goes for the School Safety Center, and then also to establish a School Safety Center grant program. And this grant program would be available to K through 12 schools of all types. So that would be public, private, charter, tribal schools, to be able to have opportunities to get funding to not only augment their safety and security within physical security, but also to include opportunity to provide, to purchase safety equipment and technology and other opportunities around training, exercising, and plan development. So with that, I will turn it over to Superintendent Drew Evans.
All right, welcome back. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans, and I'm the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Our mission is to prevent, investigate, and solve crimes in collaboration with our criminal justice partners. And in the governor's supplemental budget package, there are a couple things of vital importance that we think should be considered by this committee. The first is expanding our behavioral threat assessment and management team. This team has become vitally important as we face increasing threats, not only the political threats that you have all encountered over the past year, which continue to increase with frequency, but also to our faith-based institutions and our schools. And this supplements and dovetails well with the Homeland Security Emergency Management grant program that was just outlined. This is a multidisciplinary team for anybody who's not familiar with it. And what we look at are people that are on a pathway to violence to determine if somebody says something, does something, or is exhibiting concerning behavior, if they represent a real escalating threat where we need to have interventions, whether it be law enforcement or otherwise. And this would add additional staff with special agents, criminal intelligence analysts, and a social worker to assist us with that work. Unfortunately, in 2025, with a small team that's doing this work, we had 112 tips or cases that were reviewed and investigated by this team. Just in the first quarter of 2026, we've already taken in 105 tips and cases on pace for a 275% increase of the work of this team, which is not sustainable with the current staff. We desperately need resources to address this, and the goal is to be a statewide investigative and educational group to help expand these teams in localities, counties, and cities across Minnesota, and then act as a resource to those cities and counties as they conduct this work and work to form these multidisciplinary teams. The second component of this is the BCA works to combat all types of fraud in our financial crimes and fraud section, which composed of investigations into financial crimes, insurance fraud, state program fraud, and wage theft investigations. And this would add additional agents and, in particular, analysts, but more importantly, forensic accountants that would assist us as these cases become increasingly complex to be able to analyze the financial records that are associated with these crimes. And so you can see in front of you the recommendation would be a $1.5 million for those eight positions in fiscal year 27, and then the equivalent ongoing into the future. When it comes to this new financial crimes and fraud section, as we've discussed with you before, it's a merger of the two teams. We had 3,000 case or tip referrals in. A large portion of those are insurance fraud in that process, but there were 246 complaints of potential state program fraud. 46 were referred to other agencies. 165 were closed due to a lack of evidence, but 35 are under active investigation. There were more than 2,500 insurance fraud referrals, as noted in 2025, and many of those are ongoing, those 259 cases that were initiated in 2025. And with that, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
All right. Member discussion or questions? Representative Curran.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation, and I just wanted to, excuse me, I wanted to particularly commend you for your advocacy in the space of gun violence prevention. It's been something that's been on our minds for a long time, and of course we've been talking a lot about it this session for a variety of reasons that we've already discussed, but we just can't say enough how much we need to do something about gun violence prevention in Minnesota and across the country, and I just sincerely appreciate the efforts that you're putting forward. Thank you.
Commissioner, did you have a response?
Well, just Madam Chair, members, I just want to make a quick comment. As you know, we have a statewide safety council that is continuing to meet that was set up by an executive order of the governor. A big part of that work for the statewide safety council is surrounding gun violence and how we can prevent that and be in a preventative mode. Big focus on safety education, on behavioral threat assessment management teams. And again, I just want to reinforce the message that I think that you've heard today from Superintendent Evans, the incredible importance of the BTAM, Behavioral Threat Assessment Management Team, to identify those that may be in need and early intervention so that we can prevent significant violence happening. We do have a 90-day report out that was required under that executive order for the Statewide Safety Council. Superintendent Evans is a part of that and several others, so if you have some interest, it is posted on our website, and we'll continue that work through the remainder of 2026 to come up with an annual or a report at the end of this year emphasizing some of those key topics and key subjects. So, but thank you for the support.
And that comment leads me to ask a question about extreme risk protection orders that we did pass. I know we've seen some success with those. And does the BTAM unit, if you find somebody that you are worried about, then help coordinate with an extreme risk protection order, Superintendent?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly one component. So oftentimes when it comes to behavioral threat assessment management, we will see some sort of concerning behavior. It might be on a pathway to violence, and they analyze that. If we believe that individual represents a threat to a particular person, a community, a school, whatever that may be, there are several steps that we take. One, we work with our local law enforcement partners if it's an acute law enforcement risk, or with mental health if we need to get that individual some mental health assistance right away. If we believe they are a risk of committing violence, we work together either with our local law enforcement partners, our state patrol, with some of the threats that you as members have faced to get extreme risk protection orders so that we can make sure we secure the guns of that individual if we're concerned about it. There might be other restraining orders that we may pursue. If it's a family, it might be an order for protection. So we utilize the orders that are available, but the extreme risk protection orders we have found are a critical component of that work, and that BTAM team works together either as a unit to secure those particular orders, or we work with our local law enforcement partners to do so.
Thank you. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate it from all three of you. And I think seeing this presentation, I just want to say, and I think this is more of a comment than a question, the comprehensive approach to gun violence and the gun violence that we know is increasing in across our state, across our country, but my community with the Annunciation school shooting has just been the most recent victim. And what I see here is an approach that looks at, and we're just talking about the behavioral threat assessment unit, looks at how we treat threats, looks at prevention, and thinking about how we go upstream, thinking about the gun manufacturers who are making money putting these weapons of war in our streets, and then actually takes on the guns and the weapons that we know 69% of Minnesotans want us to get off of our streets. And so I appreciate taking that holistic approach, because we know there is, as we look at what is happening, as we look at the threats that our kids and communities face as it relates to guns, and particularly these military-style assault weapons, we know we need a comprehensive approach, and I think that this is a really a solid foundation. So thank you for the presentation, and thank you for the work.
Representative Knutson.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I guess I wasn't going to speak, but there is something that I'd like to say. I am happy to see that we have school safety grants in here that are available to both public and private schools. I just came from Education Finance Committee, where that was quite the debate, whether or not the state should be helping fund students in private schools. So I'm happy to see that it's included here, and I'm hoping that we can work forward to making sure that we're protecting all students here in Minnesota. So thank you.
Representative Bream.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. I am one of the authors of the Anonymous Threat Reporting Bill, and doing research on that, I learned about the See Something, Say Something campaign, which I think many people don't understand is a program for everyone, every school in Minnesota, public, non-public. So I really appreciate the work you're doing. Would love to hear more about how we can expand that, because I think many people are not aware of that. And so in the absence of being able to pass serious gun legislation that would ban weapons of war from our schools and from outside of our schools, I think this is the next best thing we can do, is make sure that people are able to report when they see something that looks like it could be ominous. You know, seeing someone online with an arsenal of guns, seeing their classmates bringing stuff to school. I'm really glad that we have this, but I think more people need to know about what we do at the School Safety Center. So thank you, and if you would be willing to talk a little bit more about it, that'd be great.
Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative, a great comment when it comes to this. Just so to level set for the committee and how this works, there, tips come in through a variety of means, might come in locally, but we're there to provide support. But there is also both an app and then 24/7 at the BCA, we operate our communication center that have criminal intelligence analysts that intake this. The National Threat Operations Center for the FBI, if somebody were to report a threat online, the most common example when it refers to schools would be gaming and somebody makes a comment about coming to do something at a school the next day. That gets dual routed to the FBI and then also to the BCA and the BTAM that I've been referencing, that's exactly the team that would work on that, that would reference and get that back. We then connect with our local law enforcement who have the connections with the schools to make that. We ensure that somebody's following up on that from that aspect. Also, for anonymous reporting, we do have that 24/7 and then a See It, Say It, Send It app that we currently operate that intakes those tips and they're routed through the same location. So these do work together in conjunction. It's that reporting in, and then that BTAM is the team that analyzes and works on those particular threats in that. As you note, it's not strictly for schools. It's faith-based institutions that we're concerned about, large gatherings, and then some of the political threats that we've been seeing. So it all works together, and that team addresses all of those threats. But anonymous reporting and non-anonymous reporting are critical components to be able to get that concerning behavior identified so that the proper team can take a look at it.
Any follow-up, Representative Ream?
No, just thank you for that. That's really important, and I'm glad we're bringing more attention to it, so thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question, and everybody can download that app. Again, it's See It, Say It, Send It. All right. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jacobson, has the governor explained to you how he wants to roll out this gun violence preventative package? Is he going to continue with the bills that we've heard in this committee that were voted down? Or is he going to come up with something new? Because the last time I checked, and I actually asked the bill author about the high-capacity magazine ban, it would actually turn our officers into felons as soon as they became off-duty. So I'm concerned right now about this, if we're just, you know, just playing games here, if we're actually looking to solve some of the issues, because these are unrealistic goals at this point in time if we're going to put our own cops in bad places. Can you explain a little bit?
Yeah, and before you do, I'll just say, too, that the governor always puts together supplemental budget and policy package, and I think we've known for a while that these bills were going to be in it. It did take some time to get the language back from the reviser as well. So just the timing, there might be some of that with just the drafting and how long it took to get it back to us. So I don't think we would call it playing games just because of the timing of when we got this. But if you wanted to speak more to that, Commissioner, please do.
Well, thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Duran, members of the committee. You know, certainly this is a total package from the governor's office and from the governor himself. And so, you know, we want to make sure that we present that package as best that we can. We know it's part of a total package. There's a lot of things that are involved in the governor's gun package that are outside of the firearms issues that you've referenced as well. And we think that this is really is a total package. You know, as we look at violence, you know, within our communities, there are a number of things that we can tackle. There's a number of things that we can try to do. Not everything is going to stick in every legislative session. So we just want to acknowledge that, and certainly this is can be a highly difficult and challenging process for moving legislative items through. I do believe that, you know, a total package includes, you know, education, it includes training, it includes work on firearms, it includes work on behavioral threat assessment management systems. We need to really bring safety to our schools and to our children. We're working a lot and spending a lot of time taking a look at, you know, online rhetoric that might bring children under the age of 18. I learned today that a lot of the threats that are going on and the radicalization may be occurring within young people under the age of 20. So there's a lot of things in this total package that we can take a look at that we'll get through. This gives us, guess what, a chance to be able to discuss it and put it out there. Whether people agree with it or not, that's the political process. I'm just here to represent that and to make sure that we put our best foot forward and always willing to answer questions. But again, I do think this is part of a total package. And I know that you believe, and I know this entire committee believes, that this is about creating safe communities, and the best way to get there is to be able to navigate that with all sides of the aisle coming up with the best solution to do that. I hope that answers your question, sir.
Representative Duran.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for saying that. And I actually, the reason why I brought that up is because I hate putting you guys in a political position where we're sitting here playing back and forth with you guys who are actually supposed to keep the safety of our community here. This gun violent prevention package, what's going to happen is it's going to start just ripping the fabric of everything we have apart. And I, you know, it's tough for me because I'm on the Veterans Committee, and a lot of veterans own these military-style weapons, which I'll be honest again, here we go. I'm the only one that on this committee that has been to combat and actually experienced that and haven't carried one of these yet. So when we start talking about this stuff, it just irritates me, and I like to point that out, that these are not weapons of war. I've not carried one of these in war. I've not seen one of these carried in war. So when we go down this path, it irritates me. It's going to put our, I hope when we go forward in this, we have conversations with the governor, because this is going to put a lot of our cops in jeopardy if he wants to continue down this path. It's not going to make anything better for our community or the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
I'll just say what irritates me is when someone uses a weapon like this with a high capacity magazine and guns down children in a church, and I don't remember how many bullets were fired in how many minutes, but that's what irritates me. So okay, do we have any other member comments? Chair Novotny? Nope. All right, well, thank you so much for your presentation, and we will move on to House File 1082. That is my bill. It's being used as a vehicle for the public safety finance bill. We're not taking any official action today. I'm just going to stay here because we're going to have our staff walk through the DE6 amendment and take testimony. So I will move to lay over House File 1082. And I'm just going to shift gears for a minute here. All right, I think instead of making opening remarks, I'll have staff just walk through the bill first, and then I can make some comments. Are we starting with the spreadsheet? And then, Chair Novotny, did you want to make any opening remarks at this point, or should we just go through the bill first?
I'll follow your lead, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Why don't we begin with Mr. Walls, if you want to walk through the spreadsheet.
Madam Chair, every member should have a copy of the spreadsheet in their packets. And, Madam Chair, I apologize. This is a pre-spell check version that was handed out. So on the top line, it's House File 1082, Public Safety Finance with an E. We begin on line one, the Department of Public Safety. In the BCA, there is House File 2742, non-fatal shooting clearance grants with a T, $1 million in fiscal year 2027. On line eight, Office of Justice Programs, House File 3946, the Domestic Violence Task Force, there is $214,000 in fiscal year 27 and $100,000 in fiscal year 28, which I believe completes the reporting requirement. On line 12, in the Office of Administration under Public Safety, we have House File 3095, First Responder Uniform ID Task Force, at $100,000 in fiscal year 27, which makes a total of $1.34 million for the Department of Public Safety and $100,000 entails. Under the Department of Corrections, we have four bills that all create new felony provisions, and so the numbers are bed impact. On line 23, House File 3404, impersonation of a police officer, that had a small bed impact, but was suggested to be absorbed by the governor, absorbed by the Department of Corrections in the governor's budget, and so the bill takes the same approach. On line 24, House File 3405, medical facility with two eyes, security, fourth degree assault. There's a bed impact of $34,000 for the TAILS biennium, beginning with $13,000 in fiscal year 28 and $21,000 in 29. On line 25, House File 3465, theft from a vulnerable adult. There's a bed impact of $13,000 in 27 and then $35,000 in 28, $42,000 in 29. and on line 26, House File 3489, a grooming penalty. The impact is in the tails, 13,028 and 35,029. So the Department of Corrections total is 13,000 for this biennium and 159,000 in tails. On line 32, the Peace Officer Standard and Training Board, officer with two Fs instead of three, is House File 4700, Philando Castile Training Reimbursement. Madam Chair, this is just a portion of that bill. The bill, or the amendment as now constructed, only rounds up the Philando Castile Training Reimbursement from its current level of appropriation to an even $6 million per year, and that costs $1,058,000 per year in 26 and 27, bringing the total post board to $2,116,000 in the 26-27 biennium. On line 40, we have transfers. On line 42, House File 1082, that is transfer with an end to victims of crime account for $12 million, and we show the receipt in the special revenue fund of that $12 million. Madam Chair, that brings the total for House File 1082 DE6 to $15,443,000 in this biennium and $259,000 in case.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. And next we will have Mr. Johnson walk through the DE6.
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to walk through the language. Much of this is related to what Mr. Walls just walked through, so I'm going to start at the top of page 3. This is section 4 of the bill. This is the transfer to the Minnesota Victims of Crime account. This was the underlying House File 1082, and this language is what the committee heard that was a previous delete everything amendment to this bill. The next section that you see there, it starts at page 3, line 5. This is from Representative Steers, House File 4700. This is the adjustment to the Philando Castile Training Fund. This, again, increases the amount to $6 million each year. It's slightly different from what the committee heard. On page 5, at line 1, there's a use of force carry forward. This is not a new appropriation. It's from Representative Steers, House File 3440. This matches the version the committee heard in committee. I'm moving to Article 2. If you look at page 6 at line 22, this is House File 3356, Representative Hewitt's bill. These are the provisions related to decommissioning public safety vehicles before they can be sold. No changes to the language the committee heard. On page 7, starting at line 27, this is Representative Mueller's House File 3946. This is a section that is a task force from that bill. There's one small change on page 9 at line 10. There's the addition of the word words social worker. The next section begins on page 11 at line 1. This is the task force on the standard identification. It was House File 3695. This was Representative Johnson's bill, and there are no changes from what the committee heard. The last section in Article 2 begins on line 13.22. This is Representative Frazier's House File 2742. There are a few changes from the version the committee heard. The committee heard a version that would have had ongoing funding and would have put this in statute. The grant is getting one-time funding, so it's now going to be in session law. There's also a change to the way in which the grants must be prioritized. One of the clauses was removed that required that the agency show that it had excessive number of unsolved cases and inadequate staffing. That has been removed. There's also a new paragraph B on page 14 at line 22. This would require that half of the appropriation go to agencies outside of the metropolitan area. I'm moving to Article 3. The first section in Article 3 is on page 16, starting at line 3. This is House File 3504. This was Representative Duran's bill. There's one small change. Previously, the bill referred to security officers. Now there's a security guard with a cited definition. The next few sections are from Representative Bennett's House File 3489. This goes from line 1622 to the top of page 18. These are the grooming crimes from House File 3489. The next section is the impersonating a peace officer crime. It starts on page 18 at line 3. This is Representative Cleavorn's bill, House File 3404. This is the current version that is on the floor as well.
The final section in the bill is from Representative Liebling's House File 3465. It's on page 20, starting at line 16, and this increases the penalties for theft from a vulnerable adult. Madam Chair, that's the whole bill.
All right. Thank you for that. And we do have some testifiers who signed up to speak to the DE6 amendment. We have Director Kramer and Director Bronson. You want to make your way to the testifier table. Welcome back to the committee. You want to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Kramer, and I'm the co-executive director of Violence Free Minnesota. We are a coalition of over 90 member programs that provide services to victims of domestic and sexual violence in every corner of our state. I'm here today on behalf of all six crime victims coalitions, Violence Free Minnesota, Mending the Sacred Hoop Coalition, Cinnamon is here with us today, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, and the Minnesota Children's Alliance. Together, our network of over 150 crime victim service providers ensures that every Minnesotan has a place to go when they are experiencing violence and crime. I'm here today to strongly support the request to add $12 million to HF 1082 to stabilize funding for crime victim services. Crime victim services are a core part of Minnesota's public safety infrastructure. This committee heard from many of our advocacy programs last week about the critical services provided by our network, and you will hear from one more today. Every day, advocates are working on the front lines, answering crisis calls, helping survivors create safety plans, finding emergency shelter, accompanying survivors to court, and supporting children who witness or experience violence. Across our network, programs are already operating beyond capacity. Shelters are full. Advocates are carrying overwhelming caseloads. Survivors are being placed on wait lists or turned away, not because programs don't want to help, but because they simply do not have the resources. Due to the flat funding over the past several years, combined with the increased demand for services, our programs have already had to make impossible decisions. Decisions like reducing staff, cutting violence prevention and community outreach efforts, limiting their services, or closing entire facilities. And now Minnesota crime victim services are facing a 20% cut in funding. Let me be clear about what that means. In our rural communities, a 20% reduction doesn't mean fewer services. It could mean the loss of the only domestic violence program in the area. Our fewer remaining standalone rape crisis centers and children's advocacy centers will face an even greater pressure to merge with larger organizations or close their doors entirely. When a program disappears, survivors do not stop needing help. Instead, they have nowhere to go. They may stay with an abusive partner. They may become homeless. Or the violence may escalate with consequences not only for survivors, but for children, for neighbors, for first responders, and for whole communities. Crime Victim Services coalitions and member programs are not seeking for an expansion. We are asking to maintain what already exists, to keep shelter doors open, to keep advocates in their roles, to ensure that when someone reaches out for help, there is someone there to answer. Minnesota has long been a national leader in addressing domestic violence. The coordinated community-based model we built works, but only if it's sustained. This is a pivotal moment. Chair and members, the question before you is the same one that you've heard before. What are you willing to lose? Because without this investment, we will lose services. We will lose capacity. And ultimately, we will risk losing lives. We urge you to support this funding and stand with survivors across Minnesota. Thank you for your leadership and for helping to keep our community safe.
Thank you. Welcome, Director Bronson. You can begin.
Thank you, chairs and members of this committee. My name is Tina Bronson. I'm the co-executive director of Alexandra House, Anoka County's only comprehensive domestic and sexual violence agency, serving more than 18,900 victims, survivors, family members every year. I want to tell you about Stephanie. After nearly 10 years of abuse, she fled with her children with only three small bags, and she came to our shelter. She stayed for 11 weeks. Our advocates helped her get an order for protection, stood by her in court, ensured that her kids felt safe again. Today, she has stable housing, a job, and has taken her kids on their first vacation. She told us without Alexandra House, she wouldn't have been able to do it. That's what Crime Victim Services funding makes possible, and what makes us unique. Survivors don't need to be ready to press charges, file for an order for protection, or even leave their partners when they walk through our doors. Unlike prosecutors, we don't wait for an investigation. And unlike police, we focus solely on the victim's immediate needs. We fill a niche in the public safety that would otherwise go unmet. Across Minnesota, agencies like Alexandra House are weaving together a funding quilt that has state grants, federal dollars, and private support. And that quilt is unraveling. Since 2018, our state funding has remained flat, while our inflation has risen 28%, leaving us $610,000 below our 2018 purchasing power. We've absorbed that quietly for 8 years. But that meant losing 13 positions, cutting two programs, and downsizing our physical space. A 20% cut, more than $360,000, would mean eliminating another 4 to 5 positions, gutting an entire service area. For instance, our legal advocacy is already stretched beyond capacity. 4 advocates overwhelmed with survivors waiting for help that should have been immediate. A cut of this magnitude would make that worse. Fewer advocates, longer waits, whole programs absorbed or eliminated. Anoka County would still have Alexandra House, but survivors would have far less of us. Chairs and members, echoing what you've heard, what are you and what is the state of Minnesota willing to lose by not authorizing more funding? Crime victim services are not optional. They're a critical part of our public safety systems, and we're not asking to grow. We're just asking to remain. Please protect this funding. The people of Anoka County and Minnesota are counting on you. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. We can move on to member discussion now, and I'll just note a couple of things. For the law enforcement training dollars, the amount that we ended up choosing for this bill was based on what the request was last year from the law enforcement groups that we funded at around $10 million. The request was $12 million. And so that's what this bill does, is really makes whole the request that they came to us with at the beginning of the biennium. I will say, too, for the victim services funding, and I don't know if anyone has going to have questions for you, so you could probably not have to stay there if you don't want.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would say for the victim services funding, you know, we really started talking last year about trying to create sustainable funding, because for years we have thought the federal government was going to start paying again through the VOCA funds. Again, this has spanned multiple administrations over 10 years. And so we've tried to keep their funding stable, but as they said, it hasn't kept up with costs and with inflation. So it's actually already resulted in cuts. And so the $12 million is just the bare minimum to keep this funding stable. And I really hope that in future legislative sessions, you all can think about ways to creatively find other sources of sustainable funding for these programs, because they're so vital to all of our communities. And I would encourage all the members, if you haven't done so yet, to tour any of these providers in your districts. I know that was something we talked about doing collectively as a committee this summer, and then this summer happened, so we didn't have a chance to do that as a committee, but really encourage everybody to get out and talk to the victim services providers in your district and see the great work they're doing with what little funds that they're doing. And with that, we can move to, do you want to make a comment now, or should we see if there's any discussions, Chair? Okay, discussion to the bill. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. My question, the $12 million for the Minnesota Crime Victim Services account, is that a one-time payment, or is that done by grants, or how does that get distributed?
Yeah, so I don't know if someone's here from Department of Public Safety that wants to answer. Yeah, come on up. Director Babine's here, and she can talk about how the money is distributed. The $12 million is one-time funding, and they'll distribute that the way they currently distribute their grants. Director Babine.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee. Kim Babine, Executive Director of Office of Justice Programs at the Department of Public Safety. The $12 million would be added to base funding that is that we have from the state, as well as federal funding, and would be distributed through a competitive process. That competitive process is actually already open right now. It would add, instead of having a total of this much money, it would give us about the same amount of funding that we've had in previous years. So it would be distributed through that competitive process.
Any follow-up, Representative Harder? Okay. While you're there, any other questions for Director Boehwein? Okay. You can be released.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a statutory construction question, maybe for nonpartisan staff, but I just wanted to make sure I understood. Excuse me. On page 17, we have the definition of grooming at line 17.10, and that in and of itself is a felony. And then it says may be sentenced as provided in subdivision 4, which is not subdivision 4 of this bill. And then we have the school context specifically, which carves out, says if the person is more than 36 months older than the child. And I'm just thinking about that because, like, my son is in high school and his girlfriend's a year younger than him. And so I'm just thinking, what about those relationships? I don't mean to make it weird, but I'm just like what about, like, kids who are in relationship and then one of them turns 18? Is that a felony then if they're still in a relationship? So that's my question.
All right, Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, no, that sub-offense only applies when there's a position of authority. So okay. The bill is targeting those who work at the school and come in contact with the minors, and then it establishes that 36-month gap.
Okay. Vice Chair Feist. Thank you. That's what I thought. But when I was reading it, it wasn't reading that way to me. But that makes sense to me, and I just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
Right, and I will note that in the criminal sexual conduct statutes, there is a whole section on the age differentials to try to account for those situations that you're talking about, which is already in law.
Cool, I think that. I was like, I'm not seeing it here. Cool, thank you.
All right, do you have any? Oh, okay. All right, Chair and Bonnie.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. It's a compact package that we put together that is bipartisan, and I appreciate the work that everyone put in it, including the nonpartisan staff, and look forward to getting this to the floor and getting it passed.
Thanks, Chair, and I'll just add to really appreciate, we'll have more time for comments tomorrow. That'll be the last day that you chair this committee, and I'll maybe make some more comments then too, but I'll just say it's been a pleasure working together, and I'm glad, in spite of the circumstances we've had the last couple of years, a very unusual set of circumstances and a lot of really awful and stressful events for our state, that we've still been able to put together a policy package and this finance package and pass many, many bills to the House floor. And I'm really proud of the work that we've been able to do together as a committee, and really appreciate everyone's thoughtfulness here. So thank you. All right. With that, we have nothing else on our agenda, and this meeting is adjourned.